Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Manjeet Bala from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia. You're listening to the Incomparable Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Manjeet, for introducing this edition of the Tennis Podcast. Catherine and myself, David, are here. We kind of would like you to join us, Manjeet, if you wouldn't mind, to help us with the podcast, because we haven't got Matt, for a start. He's got COVID. He's been in bed for 5 days. Catherine's got a sore throat, and she sounds like this.
I fear, Manjeet, you will today find this podcast all too comparable, but we're here and we're going to do our best despite the fact that David literally has a numb face.
Yes, I've been to the dentist and I can't quite make my mouth work normally, so those are our excuses that we thought we'd get out the way early on here. But we do have lots of tennis to talk about, and obviously it's been an incredible week in the tennis world. An incredible couple of weeks, really, since the US Open, hasn't it? So we thought we'd better do it somehow. So here we are. Just to say, if you'd like to introduce a show yourself, like Manjeet has, you can do that by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast at the intro level. Many of you have done, and hugely appreciate all the support. And as friends of the Tennis Podcast, you'll get access to now more than 20 shows, most of which in which we sound like our actual selves. Most recently in a Q&A, which I quite enjoyed doing, Catherine, when we were in New York in slightly different times.
Let's be honest, David, better times.
Yes. Yes, much better. Much better times. I can tell you, though, Catherine, since we last spoke, and this is good news, we've drawn the winner for the Australian Open competition. So we have a winner for that incredible AO travel package. Would you like to know who's won?
I would, yes. I probably warning to the Whittaker family right now, from whom I really got it in the neck for banning them from entering this competition. They said, we're paying friends just like anybody else.
Yes. I probably should have put that in the small print, shouldn't I? But no, I
Whittaker's
didn't.
Whittaker's not eligible.
No, exactly. Well, anyway, I can tell you that the winner of those two return economy flights to Melbourne, 3 nights accommodation, 4 days of tickets to the Australian Open in January, and a premium experience is going to be Lynn. Lynn from Massachusetts, who's come out of the electronic hat, out of which there were a lot of entries. I was a bit taken aback by just how many friends entered, and it was great to see that many people entering. Lynn, upon being informed that she'd won, needed to be reassured that it wasn't a hoax. She said, "I never win anything, and I'm shaking with excitement." So,
oh, love that.
We were delighted that that Lynn was so happy to have won.
It's a blooming good prize, Lynn.
It is a great prize.
Time.
Yeah, it's a really cool prize. So a big thank you to AO Travel for partnering with us during the US Open, for laying on such a brilliant prize. They're also offering a 5% discount for Friends of the Tennis Podcast. So the Whittaker family, if you'd like to take advantage of that, you can email us, friends@tennispodcast.net, if you're a friend, and we'll provide you with the details. So, you know, it's not all bad news to
pass along the info.
Yeah. The many of you that didn't win, you do get 5% off if you do want to go. So, yeah, they can sort out your accommodation, AO Travel can, tickets for the tennis, accommodation, faff-free, Catherine-style, ozopentravel.com for full details.
Outsource your faff with a 5% discount. They've not taken me up on that tagline yet.
No.
I offer it up for minimal royalties.
Yeah,
get in touch. I'm waiting by the phone.
She has actually used that in a number of conversations with me to describe things she's paid money for. Outsourcing faff.
My current state. I would pay money for someone to, eat breakfast for me in the morning. It's a really ropey state of affairs.
Oh dear. Sorry about this, folks.
That I won't outsource. Other this than the podcast, David.
Yeah. See, we thought about outsourcing this, but no, there's only us two left.
But then Matt got ill.
Exactly. We were going to just let Matt do a monologue.
The bench is empty.
Exactly. Wouldn't even do a voice note for 48 minutes like I asked for. But anyway, we get to talk, Catherine, because we at least have watched, along with everybody else that I seem to not only know from within tennis but outside of tennis, we've watched the Laver Cup and the moments, most importantly, that Roger Federer's career ended as a professional tennis player. And even knowing it was all coming and even having done the interview with Ivan Ljubicic and gone to his press conference last week and kind of expected tears, I have to say I was surprised there wasn't some emotion in that press conference in a way. And I was slightly nervous about asking him what he was most going to miss. But he seemed so at ease with his decision and as though he'd already processed it. And he described in that press conference, didn't he, that he'd kind of done some of the grieving for his career in the weeks and months that had gone before he'd actually made the announcement. So he was kind of ready for it. But I was still taken aback, massively taken aback and overwhelmed by just how emotional those scenes were on Friday night. What did you make of it all? Where on earth do you start?
I thought those scenes, which ended up unfolding at about 1 a.m. on Saturday morning, in fact, didn't they? Because scheduling Alex de Minaur against Andy Murray, even with a match tiebreak instead of a laver breaker? What do we call
it? Apparently a laver breaker
Mm, that is never going to happen. Anyway, even with a match tiebreak instead of a third set, that just had tedious marathon written all over it. It was actually really good fun, but I mean sort of tedious in terms of you just knew exactly what those points were going to look like and, you know, exhausting and never ending. So it wasn't until about 1 a.m., that Roger Federer struck his last professional tennis ball. I would like to put just a little bit of an asterisk after that comment because, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to this when we more generally discuss the Laver Cup and have the same discussion that we do annually about it. I'm not sure I do consider that to have been his last professional tennis match. I do consider it to have been his formal farewell, though. And I'm not sure I've ever seen anything quite like it. In fact, I know I haven't. I was completely overwhelmed by it, in fact, and very blindsided by that. We all knew it was coming, both in the macro and in the micro sense. You know, he's 41 years old. Of course, his retirement's been coming for a long time. He hasn't played a professional match in well over a year. We knew he'd had surgery. We knew he was up against it to get back to professional tennis, let alone to competing for Grand Slam titles. And then in the micro, we knew since his announcement, you'd recorded a brilliant podcast about it, and Matt and I had submitted our voice notes and, you know, had the opportunity to sort of assemble our feelings on it all. I'd listened to his whole press conference, which you went down to David, and I had the opportunity to process all of that and digest all of his thoughts about it. And as you said, he seemed completely in control of the decision, of the emotion. And then it was like he released the hold on the dam, didn't he? And I suppose that's been characteristic of his career. Incredible control and self-control, an incredibly controlled person, but then these little moments of extreme release where you suddenly realise what it all means and how human he is. I'm thinking in particular of the 2009 Australian Open final and that it's killing me moment, and Rod Laver presenting the trophy, Rafael Nadal pipping him at the post there, and him attempting to do the speech and simply crumpling, really. And that's what Friday night was like at the O2 Arena. The match, frankly, was underwhelming. The match didn't feel like much of an event. I found it quite difficult to watch because Federer was so compromised. I was sort of thinking, I don't need to see this. This actual match doesn't feel like anything of particular significance. I'm glad in principle that he's getting it. I'm glad that it exists. I'm glad that he has this opportunity to feel like he's taking control of his retirement within the confines of what the knee is dictating. But then the match ended and the event started with the only detractor from the whole thing for me was Ellie Goulding, who I don't know what she thought she'd been booked for.
I don't think she did either.
No, she thought she'd been booked for the Lava Cup. That's what she tweeted afterwards. Really chuffed to be to sing at the Lava Cup last night, and it was one of those, she did a sort of medley of her greatest hits, which I was sort of listening into the lyrics thinking, is there going to be a lyric at some point, that bears some sort of relation to Roger Federer's career or Federer and Nadal's rivalry? Is it all going to click? Why Ellie Goulding is here? That moment never came. Anyway, poor Ellie. I don't think it ever came for her either. But apart from that, outpouring of completely uncontrolled emotion was extremely overwhelming, not just from Roger Federer, I think in particular for me from Rafael Nadal, who was just in pieces, absolutely in pieces. It's really stayed with me for the last few days. It might even have made me ill, David, because it really hit me very hard. And for you, I know there's extra emotional weight to Federer's retirement, and the sort of, you expressed very well, the bookending for you of going to that final press conference, having been at his first professional press conference. I'm sure you were hit in similarly hard ways.
Yeah, and that's not because of any relationship I have with him. I don't have a relationship with him. Yes, he knows who I am because of all those years ago. It's in my case, I think it's just simply a case of age, and it's a sort of moment that hits you when you realize you're getting older and things are changing, and somebody can come into your life like Federer came into mine, and that happened in the first year of my professional career on the ATP circuit as a communications manager, and seeing this 16-year-old and me not going through the best of times when I saw him in Gstaad back in 1998. I'd just been quite unwell at a tennis tournament, basically because I'd overdone it. I've just pushed myself too hard. I'd ended up in hospital. This was my first tournament back. I met Federer as part of my duties, and he just had this disarming way of putting me at ease and making everything seem fresh and enjoyable and doable. I don't know how to put it other than to say that. He just made it all seem like this was a good time. And that's kind of what he's been able to do throughout his career, is make everybody feel like this doesn't need to be hard work. This is actually great fun. Yes, you have to travel and all the rest of it, but this is great. I'm a tennis player. And so I always enjoyed that about him. But seeing him retire at the other end so long afterwards, I mean, not many players have a 24-year career. Some do, you know, Martina Navratilova, Jimmy Connors, but there are not many. And that's the first time that I've kind of gone through a player's career of that length and come out the other side. And it stopped me in my tracks a bit to remind me of the fact that we're getting older. And okay, there's my midlife crisis out of the way in this podcast. And I think that's kind of...
If you also spent the weekend listening to Thunder Road, David. Like, where's Matt when you need him?
I know.
Bloody COVID.
But I think to some degree that happened to Rafael Nadal on Friday night. Because sitting there, I mean, look, he's going through a major event in his life at the moment anyway. His wife is heavily pregnant. It's not been an easy pregnancy from what we're told in reports. And he'd made this incredible gesture, I think, to come away from home to turn up for Roger Federer's retirement party, effectively. He didn't come for the Laver Cup on its own. If Roger Federer's not retiring, he's not playing that Laver Cup, and totally understandably so. That's not to diss the Laver Cup. It's just that, look, he's got a massive personal event going on in his family. He's turned up one day later than everybody else. He's played the match. He's had the aftermath, and he's left immediately, and 100% understandably. But sitting there, and I'm sure some of the emotions of what he's going through in his life at the moment are part of it, but I think he's seen Roger Federer, his greatest rival and a marker for his own career and his own life, an ever-present, depart the scene. And inevitably, he's thinking about his own tennis mortality in that moment, I'm sure. Andy Murray slightly alluded to it in one or two of his comments, and I think it's partly why we saw such a fatigued performance from Murray on Friday night himself, is that he's invested so much emotion, he's experienced so much emotion over the last few days talking to these other players in a way that he probably wouldn't ever have done before. And I think it is one of the things that is a real positive about the Laver Cup, is it puts these players in each other's company in a way they're not usually in each other's company. But I think it exhausted Murray, absolutely decimated Nadal, in an emotional sense. But to see them sitting there, you could see, first of all, in the distance, you could see Nadal when Federer is getting paraded in the centre of the court and he's applauding all sides. You could see him start to break down, just quietly on his own at the back, trying to stay out the way because he knew he couldn't control it anymore. And then once he sat down with Federer alongside him, I know that there's that shot that you sent to Matt and I, and then you eventually tweeted it and said you don't think you'll ever get over this, looking at that shot of the two of them side by side, weeping uncontrollably, unapologetically. And then a wonderful photo from Ella Ling got shared as well the following morning. The photographer Ella Ling and a couple of other photographers I know got that shot as well of Federer putting a reassuring, consoling, understanding hand on top of Rafael Nadal's hand in front of 17,000 people and millions watching all around the world while they sobbed uncontrollably. And I think that that is a beautiful thing, I really do, that they are prepared to show how they really feel in the moment and about each other to the world. Yeah, it's something I'll never get over, and it's something I don't want to get over. I want to be reminded of that, because I think it's a great thing that they have brought to the sport, aside from their tennis and their rivalry and everything else. It's maybe helped a lot of people to understand that you can show emotion and it's just fine.
Mm. Yeah, my stomach just lurched just hearing you describe that photo, David, let alone actually looking at the thing. I can't imagine ever looking at that photo and it not stirring something in me. It's quite extraordinary. There's so much in it, so much that I'm not sure I'm even able to describe. I mean, that is why rivalries matter in the sport, that picture. I know not every rivalry can be that rivalry or be Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. Maybe none will ever be as good as those two again. I don't know. But even just, you know, an ounce of what that picture demonstrated is worth having in the sport and essential to the sport. Even it was interesting how Andy Murray didn't let the walls of the dam up, did he? I felt like he couldn't let it in. He wasn't in a place of readiness for whatever reason to let it go on Friday night, whereas Nadal just completely let everything go. And again, Nadal is somebody that incredibly controlled, and then he doesn't mean it's not there, you know, doesn't mean they don't have their outlets for it. It's just we rarely see those outlets, and we saw it all on Friday night. And yeah, I'm sorry I'm doing such a poor job of summing up all the emotion that it evoked, but it's almost too much. Maybe Ellie Goulding's got some lyrics that can help us all process this moment. It's like trying to get inside the mind of Nadal and those tears and where they were coming from. I think you've done a brilliant job of that, but it's like Federer was his totem. You know, it's like Federer tethered him to the tennis world, even more so than Nadal did for Federer, because, of course, Federer was there before Nadal. Nadal's never known tennis without Federer. He's always been defined by Federer.
It's like Matt with the big three.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. He doesn't know what tennis looks like. He doesn't know what he looks like. Now, I do back him on the court to still be the same person, for the fact of Federer's not being there, not to affect him tennis-wise, because that's who he is, isn't he? When he plays tennis matches, he just goes into a zone where all he sees is a tennis ball, you know, and is magically able to block everything else out. But I do think off the court and in his life, this is going to have quite a profound effect on him. Now, as you said, obviously he's got a lot else going on that all distract him in well, mostly wonderful ways, but, you know, stressful ways as well. But it's going to be interesting. We may never know. We may never hear Rafael Nadal tell us or express to us exactly how profound an effect it's having on him and will have. Maybe he'll never be able to. But it's a lot. It's a lot for us, and it's clearly a lot for them.
Well, and I do think it might help them both. I certainly think Federer understood when he was at that press conference that being amongst his peers in that moment, okay, you know, we'll get on to the whether it was his final professional match or not, but it was certainly his goodbye, and it was amongst familiar company and important company for him. I think getting all of that out will do him good in terms of moving on. And I think it might do Nadal good to just, you know, he's been forced to face it. I think it might even do Murray good, or all of them, really. It's just given them a chance to just consider where they are in their careers and lives. So I'm grateful for that on their behalf. You know, we'll see where else their lives and their careers end up taking them. Just on that moment, Catherine, I mean, we'll go on to the results of the Laver Cup in a minute. But that line about it not being considered his final professional match, I assume therefore you mean that the Hubert Hurkacz match at Wimbledon is what you consider to be his final professional match, Federer's.
Yeah, unfortunately. I would love to think that his last set played wasn't a 6-love set lost to Hubert Hurkacz on centre court at Wimbledon, but I think it was. That's not to, I'm wary of going over old ground, Laver Cup. I don't think it does it down to call it an exhibition. I believe the best thing for the Laver Cup is to totally embrace and lean into being an exhibition. Big it up as the best exhibition in the world. And maybe over years, decades, it will grow into something more than that. You know, as we said, the Ryder Cup is technically an exhibition, but you can't create meaning out of nothing. And I don't think that rankings points or ATP legitimacy does anything to shortcut any of that. I just think that that and many other aspects of it just make it seem like they are trying to have it all. They're trying to have legitimacy as well as the gloss of the exhibition. You know, they had to change the rules to allow Roger Federer to be able to play. There is absolutely no way that Roger Federer was the best team selection for winning that match and accumulating points, which if it were a legitimate tournament, that would come ahead of everything else. Now, I'm absolutely delighted that Roger Federer played that tennis match. I'm delighted that the Laver Cup exists and existed and gave Roger Federer that opportunity and that platform to have a place to say goodbye, to do it on his own terms. It felt really fitting. But it was an exhibition. That match, the tournament, was an exhibition. It's clearly an exhibition that meant quite a lot to some players. Definitely means a lot to John McEnroe. We know he, you know, I've seen him play Champions Tour events, many of them which are exhibitions. He can't turn that tap off. But it's not a professional tennis match. That wasn't, and I don't consider any of the matches played over the weekend professional tour level tennis matches, and I think that is fine for the Laver Cup. I don't think exhibition is a dirty word. It won't be for everybody. Not everybody's into watching exhibition sport, but plenty of people will be. There's a market for it, clearly, because it's packaged so well for those that do want to engage and indulge in it.
I think one of the problems tennis has is the word exhibition generally being associated with hit and giggle. And this wasn't hit and giggle at all. This was a really competitive exhibition. I think most of the tennis was quite good. I think that the players were trying to win matches. At least that's how it looked to me consciously. I don't think anybody's sort of trying not to win. Just generally speaking, I mean, I think it is brilliantly produced. I think they do a fantastic job with the event. They sell the thing out. All the things that we've said in the past still apply today. And I think that may grow in the future. But look, just on the question of it being staying within rules and that sort of thing, if it's the epitome of sport, I don't think John McEnroe says absolutely fine, bend the rules to my potential detriment, or to whatever it might be. It's just not going to be like that. Frankly, I think I'm not sure if it was like a Ryder Cup that John McEnroe would still be in the job, having lost four times in a row. That's not to say that. Obviously, he had a worse hand dealt to him in terms of players at his disposal than Team Europe and all the rest of it, but still he lost four times in a row. The last time was 14-1. Okay, they won this one. Anyway, I tend to agree. Federer lost 6-love in that final set of that match at Wimbledon, and I'm delighted that he had this chance, but it's not the same, and that's just the way it is. It's quite interesting talking to my circle of friends, and in fact people that were messaging me that I haven't heard from in ages, who were messaging me about, because they were watching the Laver Cup and they were watching Federer's retirement moment and being introduced to this format and absolutely loving it. And a lot of people on social media, when I tweeted that Federer's movement bothered me watching him play like this, and I just find it sad. It's just a reminder that he's not able to do it anymore. That was another little reminder that he's right to be retiring because he can't move properly. And not everybody could see that, and I understand why, because we've seen it in the Champions Tour in the past. If you're not exposed to it regularly, you can be lulled into thinking they can still do it at a certain high level. And it doesn't mean they're not athletes of any kind and they're not hugely skillful. You could see his skill set still. You could still see the instincts and the ability he's got. But he wasn't serving a volleying at all. Of course he wasn't. His knees weren't allowing him to do that. And if you want to be sure of it, do what I've done over the last week. I've gone back and watched a lot of him at his best in the last week on YouTube. I watched the 2015 match against Andy Murray in the semi-finals. I've watched him beat Andy Roddick in the semi-finals of the Australian Open in 2007. I've watched the Wimbledon final even only 3 years ago against Novak Djokovic when he nearly won. His movement is crazy. He's all over the court. He's not breathing heavily. He's not ever once juddering to a halt and not being able to push off. It's night and day, the difference. And of course it is. That's why he's retiring. So, you know, but I'm still happy this event exists. I think it's mostly good for the sport. There are things I'd like to change. I would like to bring women in and have it be a men and women tournament. And I'd love to see everybody get together and just make sure it fits in without getting in the way of anything else. But, you know, generally speaking, I think it's a really well-run event, and I enjoy seeing the players in a different scenario, and I like the fact that 100,000 people came through the doors and enjoyed it. So, all good. Just in terms of the matches that we saw, it was 2-2 after day one. Quite interesting this, Catherine. You know how they've got this this scoring system of 1 point for a win on day one, 2 points for a win on the Saturday, and then 3 on the Sunday, which personally I don't like that. I don't like that kind of, it's a manipulation of trying to make sure it's all still live on Sunday. Mm. And unless, look, I don't mind it as long as you're not saying that that's sport. that very much is exhibition. It's a bit WWE, you know. And again, I don't mind it as long as it's that. Mm. But as it turned out, they didn't play the final match of the day. And if it had only been 1 point for a win all the way through, they'd have played the final match, which was quite interesting.
Did you do a stat, David?
I did a stat, and I could have used it in the newsletter. And in the absence of Matt being ill, and now I've given it away. Now I've got to think of another one. Sign up to the newsletter and see if I figure it out. But yeah.
Interesting.
It was 8-4 after day two, which, you know, should have been 5-3 if it was 1 point for a win. And then Team Worlds won the next 3 points on Sunday, effectively, but that then ended the whole thing because they're all worth three each.
They suffered Team Europe from not having a decent doubles team, didn't they? And, you know, part of that was Federer and Nadal playing on Friday, which, you know, that was an event entirely separate, really, from the World versus Europe competition. Berrettini and Murray, Andy Murray, I think, is a very good doubles player, but he needs the right partner. And I don't think Matteo Berrettini has ever played a whole lot of doubles, has he? That didn't gel. And then what doubles partnership did we have on? I think they did win the Saturday doubles, didn't they? On the Saturday, it was Berrettini and Djokovic, wasn't it? They did win, actually, straight sets over Sock and de Menor. So, you know, not a disaster doubles wise, but Jack Sock was
in all of them.
He was in all of them. He was a bit of a hero, wasn't he, for Team World? And he was, you know, rankings wise, in terms of singles, should have been the weak link across both teams, shouldn't he? So these are teams selected not on the basis of rankings or matchups or doubles teams. It's selected on the basis of selling tickets and being glitzy and eye-catching, which is absolutely fine. But again, it's having your cake and eating it, isn't it? You know, it's not, those aren't necessarily the selections you'd have made if the one and only goal were accumulating as many points as possible.
Hmm. The other thing that really cost them, I mean, one was they just kept giving away leads. On the final day, they won that final set, that first set of the doubles, 6-2, did Murray and Berrettini, and then Tsitsipas won the first set against Tiafoe, 6-1, and both of them looked like they were just going to be runaway wins for Team Europe. And actually, you know, fair play, particularly to Tiafoe for coming back in that final one. he's just so good when he gets into it. When the difference between him when he's into it and fired up and the crowd's involved and him when those things are not the case, you are looking at two completely different players. And we've seen that throughout his career. And it was great to see London getting a bit of the Tiafo vibe, I thought. I enjoyed that.
London got to see Tiafo in a lever breaker. What could be better?
And actually, Felix Auger-Aliassime got a great win over Djokovic. Now, Djokovic on the Saturday night was so good that... I don't feel like I should be getting taken aback by how good Novak Djokovic is. But this is a guy who hasn't played a tennis match on a competitive court since Wimbledon. That's a long time out. And I mean, the level he produced was just ridiculous, I thought, on Saturday night. And it was Tiafoe he beat, wasn't it? And then he teamed up for the doubles as well. But then the next day he came out and I didn't see the match. I was at my kid's tennis, but people were saying that he looked as though he got a bit of a sore wrist, which is not that surprising. I mean, that's two matches in one night, having not played for quite a while. And Auger-Aliassime was really good. And he continues to sort of confound, doesn't he? Because I feel like I've got to grips with who Auger-Aliassime is, one way or the other. And then he goes and either disappoints me or absolutely surprises me with how well he's played. And I suppose, therefore, I should stop putting him in a box. But I am interested that he's able to produce it some of the time and not more often, really.
Oh, and it's when those times are that are completely confounding as well. You know, he's beaten Alcaraz and Djokovic in the week since the US Open, hasn't he? But lost first round of the US Open to Jack Draper, who played brilliantly. But, you know, I remember you commentated on that match, David, and Jack Draper just looked like the higher ranked player. He looked like the more solid player throughout. It's one thing, you know, a kid showing up and playing lights out purple patch tennis, but it's another thing looking more solid and secure and confident than Felix Auger-Aliassime. I don't think the problem is the top level for Auger-Aliassime. I don't think, you know, beating Alcaraz and Djokovic doesn't tell me that much new about him. What he needs to change to sort of clear up some of my confusion and hesitation over him at the moment is the inexplicable losses and the one-sidedness of them. It was Canada, wasn't it? Who was it to? He lost, I think, in the quarterfinals, one of the worst... It might have been Casper Ruud. One of the worst performances I've ever seen, actually. He was awful. Absolutely awful. And that, it was quite alarming. I remember that was as alarmed as I've been about Felix Auger-Aliassime, because that was home crowd. He'd been playing well all week. And he just did not show up in a way that you don't really see from top players. You know, yes, bad days, but it was very drastic. So I still, that question mark very much remains over him for me. But look, these are good wins. His top level is fantastic. I just worry about that ability to go through gears that the very top players have.
Yeah, it was 6-1, 6-2, that match you referenced in Canada.
It was Casper Ruud.
Yeah, you're right. That was quite a lopsided one, that one. So that was the Laver Cup.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Also going on last week were a couple of ATP events and a couple of WTA events as well, which caught my attention. It was one of those because the late nights were so extreme because of the Laver Cup, but then Emma Raducanu was playing in Seoul. We were still getting up early in the morning, a lot of the British media were, to watch her matches, and actually she played really well, I thought. She won three successive matches for the first time since the US Open last year. She reached a semi-final for the first time since last year. Ended up losing to Yelena Ostapenko despite winning the first set. Had to retire in set number three. Simon Briggs has written a piece saying, you know, she has to invest now in somebody who's going to help build her a physique and a robustness that can handle the tour, because I think it is something like five retirements since the US Open that she won. And look, I do think there's a lot to say for what Simon's writing there. And I'm sure Emma Raducanu will know that herself. I mean, she's not going to be happy and satisfied with what's going on just at the moment. But just in terms of the level she produced, and I know it was a WTA 250, so it was a lot lower level, but I was encouraged by her tennis, much more so than I was at Wimbledon earlier this year and also at the US Open. I think that some of the solidity and the ambition to her ball striking was back, and she was withstanding the power of the opponents again. So, you know, good luck to her as she tries to figure it all out. But it was Ostapenko who reached the final. Eventually lost out to Ekaterina Alexandrova, 7-6, 6-love. I mean, Ostapenko, Catherine, on her own, she would make a tournament draw for me. And that's probably always been the case, but because I was exposed to a few of her matches this week and there weren't that many big names, I realised she's just one of the best watchers around still.
Oh, yes. Yes, I just love receiving any message in the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group with the word Ostapenko in it, because I know it's going to lead to a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. she's just non-stop entertainment, isn't she? Always delivers. She's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but
no,
she doesn't mind that. I don't mind that. I love it. She's just great.
So Alexandrova won the title. The doubles title was won by Kristina Mladenovic and Janina Wickmeyer. In Tokyo, the title was won there, the singles, by Ludmila Samsonova. She didn't drop a set. She beat Zheng Qinwen, 7-5, 7-5 in the final, who is continuing to make strides. It's easy to forget that Zheng is only 19, and we'd only heard of her for the first time, really, at the French Open this year, at least I had. And Samsonova, she kind of keeps quietly doing this. She doesn't get the headlines, but she often wins titles.
Yes, I think it was Ben Rothenberg on Twitter that pointed out that she's on an incredibly similar trajectory this second half of the season to what Annette Contaveit was on last year, just hitting form, bulldozing through, slightly disappointing at the slams. She was slightly disappointing at the US Open, wasn't she? I think she reached third round, didn't she? But hasn't quite done it at the highest level. But at tour level, she's just sort of sweeping all before her at the moment. So I expected to have an incredibly disappointing 2023, as Annette Contaveit has, kind of a blessing and a curse. But it will be interesting. You know, it's the perennial thing of having success at the end of a season post US Open. What does it mean? How do you carry on the momentum? How do you keep it going into the following season? Many a great player has struggled with it. Garbina Muguruza has struggled with it. It's going to be very interesting.
Also, a bit of disappointing news in Tokyo was that Naomi Osaka was forced to withdraw from her match, I think round two or round three in Tokyo, which, you know, it's always a shame to see her unable to play at any time, but particularly in Tokyo. So I hope she's fit again soon. The doubles title was won by Gabby Dabrowski and Juliana Olmos. So well done to them. And in the ATP tournament in Metz, which has got a soft spot in my heart after I suggested Metz might be the tournament, I think, many a time ago that Felix Auger-Aliassime should try and win. He was otherwise involved in Laver Cup, and also he's already won Rotterdam this year. So he got his win in the end, Catherine.
You don't need Metz after you've scaled the heights of Rotterdam.
That's right. But Lorenzo Sonego did, and he won the title. So that was all right for him.
Next
and
stop, actually, Rotterdam, Lorenzo.
Yes. And he's had a terrible time, hasn't he, really, a lot of this year. I've noticed, you know, he actually said in his post-match quotes that he's had a difficult time of late. And if you look at his year, he lost a lot of matches having broke on the scene last year and really sort of announced himself. But he won this title. He beat Alexander Bublik 7-6, 6-2. There was a point during the rounds halfway through the second set where Bublik tries to do a put-away forehand with his racket handle, which didn't go down well in all quarters. Where do you stand on that kind of...
What was the score?
Frivolity. It was something... I mean, it was a live match, still very much a live match at this point, and he's about to win the point. He turns the racket upside down, holds the head of the racket and tries to put it away with his handle, skews it off and loses the point.
He's one of those players that brings into question entire philosophical debate about tanking, isn't he? When is tanking not tanking? When is tanking strategic tanking? When is it actually sort of in the big picture good for the individual? You know, he has to do it that way, doesn't he? That's the only way he can play professional tennis. And sometimes he needs to sort of tank a few points in order to sort of regroup for the remainder of the match. So I'd say I'm going to sit on the fence and say context is everything. I can't give a ruling without greater context. I think there are some scenarios in which I would find that offensive to the sport and some in which I would laugh and enjoy it very much.
Yes. Okay. Fine. I'll take that as an answer. Actually, I mean, really, the story of the tournament in many ways was Stan Wawrinka, who got to the semi-finals and really rolled back the years for a few rounds. He beat Daniil Medvedev, who seemed to have a bit of a mental capitulation in the middle of that match. He just seemed to lose his mind with the crowd. Some of the gestures that he was giving towards them were a bit concerning, I've got to be honest. But Stan Wawrinka was brilliant, and unfortunately for him, in the semi-finals, he pulled out midway through injured. So just hope he's going to be okay, because at this point where Federer's leaving and we're seeing Nadal and Murray trying to hold on and to their careers, the more we can get out of Stan Wawrinka, the better, because he's just good times to watch as a tennis player, isn't he, Catherine? Still, when you watch him hit his stride, there's still nothing quite like him.
Yeah, and Matt, in his early stages of illness and jet lag upon returning from the US this time last week, very much enjoyed Wawrinka Medvedev, didn't he? He was glorying in that Wawrinka performance on our WhatsApp group moments before being struck down by Lurgy. Yes.
We're not used to Matt just suddenly going quiet and not being very well.
I'm on the edge of my seat here, Matt. What happened?
Sorry, can't talk at the moment. I suddenly feel absolutely awful. But anyway, get well soon, Matt, is the most important thing. And get well soon, Stan Wawrinka, too. Doubles title was won by Nears and Zielinski in the ATP San Diego tournament, which was overnight our time. First title for Brandon Nakashima, won in his home city and over a practice partner in Marcus Garon. Nice story that for Nakashima. I saw some of the moments at the end of it. He was really quite overwhelmed. It was his third final of the year. It's his first title. He's up to 48 in the rankings. I don't really know what the prospects are for Nakashima. He seems like a good, solid player who doesn't let you down, but I'm not sure whether there's a top 20 in him, for instance. But a good player and a good pro.
Yeah, I definitely don't think he's done rising up the rankings. I definitely think he'll be top 30, probably a top 20 player. Remains to be seen if he'll go any further than that. Doesn't have a big weapon. Not that, you know, you can get to the top without a big weapon. See Novak Djokovic. But you have to be so blooming good at everything. And he's very, very good at everything. He's just not Novak Djokovic. But I think he's mentally very tough. I've seen a few matches of his where I've been really impressed with his temperament on the court. And that can take you very far. And lovely, smooth strokes. He's one of those players that it's very easy to damn with faint praise. You know, solid, dependable, yeah. Lots of unsexy words. But he's a very good tennis player and easy to watch.
Yeah. Just a note on the Davis Cup group stages that we missed out on covering last week because of being away for a week. That was the week before the one just gone, and it was the group stages held in four venues, one in Italy in Bologna, one in Valencia in Spain, one in Hamburg, Germany, and one in Glasgow, Great Britain, which is the one we were obviously concentrating more on. That was the one that was in front of us. It was shown on the BBC iPlayer, so got to see quite a lot of that. And in the matches that Britain were involved in, absolutely brilliant atmosphere. And actually Britain, the only host nation not to go through, beaten by the United States and Netherlands in final sort of rubber doubles matches, which I really enjoy as a concept. I mean, these matches are now best of three rubbers as opposed to best of five when two nations meet, but they've got to play three matches in their group stages. I quite like the idea of having the doubles deciding it all. I know it does sometimes mean that those matches don't get played, but I did enjoy them. And actually, you know, you were talking earlier on, Catherine, about playing the best doubles team. And in the instance of the British team in Davis Cup, they chose Andy Murray, who's obviously been there, done it, has been a brilliant doubles player, has been a brilliant singles player, has won the Davis Cup almost single-handedly for Britain. Okay, not single-handedly, but a massive part of their win in 2015. But he was part of the two doubles teams that lost in Glasgow, and they did have Neil Skupski, an excellent doubles player, on the bench. It asks another question, I suppose, doesn't it? And it's I personally understand why Leon Smith made that call. I probably would have done the same thing myself. But, you know, what do you do? What do you go with the old hero who might not quite have it anymore? Or do you go for the established doubles player in that situation? It's so difficult.
Yeah, well, in the words of Dan Evans that I had ringing in my ears throughout those defeats last week, when he was being asked after his second round win at the US Open, I went to his press conference after that, and that was we had a lot of men do well in the first week of the US Open, didn't we? Lots of them through to round two, I think four of them through to round three, with some people predicting that all four of them would go through to round four. And Dan Evans was being asked about, you know, what that meant for Leon Smith's decisions at the Davis Cup, and it was put to him, look, Andy Murray's probably currently, you know, the weakest on this list. And Dan quipped back, well, you'd be a brave man not to pick Andy Murray to play in Glasgow. And maybe it was a touch of the Laver Cups about it, you know, perhaps a slightly sentimental pick. I don't know if it feels wrong to say that about Andy Murray. He's still an extremely good tennis player and has won great doubles matches, but I do think he needs the right partner. And, you know, it's not like there was no evidence for Murray and Salisbury's success together on doubles court. They beat Herbert Mahou at the Olympics last year, didn't they? And lost out to Mektić Pavic. No shame in any of that. So there was some data to suggest they'd been successful. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I'd have been very tempted to play Dan Evans and Neil Skubsky, who have had really great recent success on the tour in doubles, proven as a team together. But I know Dan Evans was playing singles and as well, and that would have been a big ask. But I think physically he's up to it. I mean, he's as fit as he's ever been. He can't get enough of playing tennis. That's probably what I'd have gone with, but that's extremely easy for me to say.
Yeah, and that is the one thing with Britain's good doubles players. They're good doubles players at the moment with non-British partners. Mm. Joe Salisbury with Rajiv Ram, Neil Skupski with Wesley Kuhlhoff. So, you know, you can understand that it's not straightforward. There's not an obvious choice. There's a lot of good contenders for it. In the other groups, Italy threw 3-0 in Group A at home. Second was Croatia. Spain topped Group B in Valencia, but only just. They took a loss at the hands of Canada. We mentioned the win for Carlos Alcaraz, for Ogier Aliassime rather, over Carlos Alcaraz, and Canada ended up being second. Now, this was a bit controversial, Catherine, because Canada lost 4-0 in the qualifying rounds in March, but they were given a wild card into the group stages in September by the Davis Cup steering committee as replacements for last year's champions Russia, who've been banned from the competition as a result of the invasion of Ukraine. Now, Andy Roddick tweeted out over that weekend, that it would be tough to consider Canada legitimate champions if they ended up winning the event. He said that the rule was made up on a whim to allow them in. Marty Fish, the US Davis Cup captain, he'd already been outspoken about that fact, wondering what on earth Canada was still doing in the event. I mean, it does make it difficult because, well, what do you do with the place that had been occupied by Russia? Roddick reckons they should have just left a space, you know, and basically had a bye. Other people were saying, well, in qualifying, you can lose and go and enter as a lucky loser and win a tournament. But Roddick was saying, well, there's no precedent for that in the Davis Cup. And that's the difference. So it's an interesting one, isn't it? But it's wound up a lot of people. That.
And the lucky loser in that scenario isn't chosen by steering committee. The lucky loser, I know there's a slightly arbitrary system of sort of who can sign in the quickest, but there is still some sort of independent feeling system. Steering committee doesn't feel right. No matter how pure the intentions of that committee, that doesn't feel right. There needs to be something formal, written in stone. This is what happens. If you're not going to go
initially, it was ranking.
Right.
But Serbia were already in, and they were the next ones ranked sufficiently highly.
So then don't you keep going down the rankings?
Yeah, I mean, and I think maybe that's what they did do. I'm not entirely sure. But even so, it really did wind people up, that did. And we'll make it very interesting now, because
it'll be
Canada were brilliant.
If they do well, if they win, they absolutely could win. They got great players.
Yeah. So we'll wait and see what ends up happening with that. Serbia, by the way, third and out. Despite winning two of their three matches, Novak Djokovic didn't play this set of ties. But they still won two out of their three and don't go through. In Hamburg, Germany topped the group 3-0. They weren't playing with Alexander Zverev. He was due to play, but he sustained another injury, which sounds as if it might end his season, actually. This is a different one to the sprained ankle he had at the French Open. He got it in practice, apparently, in the lead-up to this thing. So Jan-Lennard Struff and Oscar Otter played the singles. They won all of their ties 2-1. Australia also through. They finished second. France are out. So that's completes the lineup for the Davis Cup finals, which will be taking place basically the end of the season, aren't they? They're in November after the ATP finals, so late November, and that's all going to take place in Malaga. Just on a quick final note, just on the crowds, I mentioned those ties that involving Britain were really well attended. Fantastic crowds in Glasgow, great atmosphere. Not the case in every tie between every nation. probably understandably, between nations that weren't the home nations. One of our colleagues showed a video in Germany, in Hamburg, of two nations that weren't Germany, and there weren't that many people in the crowds. Now, Cosmos, who obviously own the Davis Cup these days, they said that between 13th and 18th of September, a total of 113,268 people attended the group stage of the Davis Cup by Rakuten Finals 2022 across the four cities. This mirrors the numbers achieved in 2021 for the entire group stages and the knockout stages. So there was a significant increase on previous years. That's 113,000. Just compare that, though, to the Laver Cup, which brought through 96,000 in just six sessions in one city. And I think that you get understand. And look, I don't think either event is perfect. I'd love to combine the two somehow and have the sort of staging and the panache of the Laver Cup and all that it brings, but the meaning of the Davis Cup, which is still something where you would not get people opposing captains, you know, letting you get through on a technicality in order to let somebody play a final match, if that's how it was not meant to be in the rules. You know, it's just interesting to compare and contrast the two. And I think it shows that Davis Cup, well, I think they're trying to work it out, aren't they? They've tried to make it. They've made a big change. They've realised elements don't work. I think that this was better, having lots more home ties for four of the nations. But they've still got a way to go, I think, in truth. So we'll see what it ends up like in Malaga. Now, next week, there are ATP 250 events. Quite interesting this, that Novak Djokovic is playing in Tel Aviv in Israel, the tournament there, alongside Marin Cilic and Diego Schwartzman. In Sofia, Jannik Sinner's playing with Pablo Carreño Busta, Lorenzo Musetti as well. In Seoul, Casper Ruud, Cameron Norrie, Taylor Fritz and Denis Shapovalov. We've got WTA 250s in Tallinn with Annette Kontaveit, Belinda Bencic and Beatriz Haddad-Meyer. In Parma, we've got Maria Sakkari and Sloane Stephens. So loads of events happening this week. We'll keep an eye on all of them. We aim to be back a week from now, hopefully all feeling a bit better than we are, and hopefully with Matt back in town. We're going to save the shout outs for when Matt returns.
No one wants their shout out on this episode, David.
Not least because I don't know how to get hold of them without Matt. I also want to say get well soon to Darius Saville, who tore an ACL, the anterior cruciate ligament.
Can't catch a break, can she? Poor
so
thing.
Sorry for her. And I hope she can make a full recovery. Yeah, and be here, back to good health very soon. We'll also save the mascot this week because I don't know what we do without Matt. I'm going to have to figure this out, aren't I, in case he's not fit next week. But what I can do is say hello to our mascots. That's Darwin, Carter, and the dearly departed Gerald. To our executive producers, Chris Albert-Lee and Carl Weingartner. To Billie Jean, the dog's sponsor, Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. And yeah, we don't have shout-outs. So, Catherine, all I can say is thank you for still appearing on this
for
podcast.
Inflicting yourself on the listeners.
Despite
because
the state
we had
of
no
us.
Other option.
No.
You're welcome, David. Likewise.
And thank you all for listening. And if you're still listening now, you're the true listeners. So we'll see you all next week. Take care. And bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.